This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you been struggling lately? Maybe you're having trouble sleeping, difficulty with a relationship, or just suffering from low self-esteem. If so, then BetterHelp wants to help you. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen and to help you. You get to talk to your therapist in a private online environment at your convenience. There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's 20,000 plus therapist network, and they give you access to help that may not be available in your area. You just need to fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Join the 2 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. And there's a special offer to Nowhere to Be Found listeners. You'll get 10% off of your first month, but only if you go through the link or type in betterhelp.com/NTBF for Nowhere to Be Found. That's better, HELP.com/NTBF. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. And you can find the link in our show notes and on our website, nowheretobefoundpodcast.com. Tonight's episode is brought to you by Oregon Wild Rice. Oregon Wild Rice is a local company that we are so excited to be partnering with. The Langdon family have been farming in Harrisburg for approximately 120 years. They started out as a farm to sustain their growing family and then grew into commercial farming. 80 years ago, they acquired 140 acres with heavy clay soil. For 75 years, the family had drained the land and tried to grow grass seed with varying results. 5 years ago, they decided to stop fighting the land. They moved some dirt, built berms on two sides, and within 3 days, they had rice paddies. So far, they have not had to add water to the paddies. Oregon Wild Rice grows in 100% Oregon rain. I love that this rice is locally grown and sustained right here in Harrisburg. It's important to know where your food comes from these days. Here in the Pacific Northwest, it doesn't get any better than Oregon Wild Rice. I got to try their wild rice recently, and I can honestly say that I've never seen rice like this before. I'm genuinely a picky eater and greet most foods with skepticism, but I was blown away. Their rice is a healthy, delicious, better choice side dish. So thanks again to Oregon Wild Rice for sponsoring tonight's episode. I'll post the link to their website in our show notes so you can check them out. It's been 83 days since my life changed and I took on the Michael Bryson case. It's been a roller coaster, and I'm at the point where I need to organize the information I have so I can start piecing everything together. I've said before that while interviewing, I try to stay completely unbiased, and I try to pretend like I don't have a personal opinion. Which, of course, like everyone else, I do. I want to walk you through what my experience has been on a more relatable level. So here's the recap of the last 3 months of my life in relation to this case. I first heard about Michael being missing on Facebook. I saw the flyer, and I saw that we had some mutual friends, but he didn't look familiar. A few days later, I saw his parents on the news, and I recognized Parrish, his dad, as my UPS guy from a job I had. It caught my attention enough to where I started looking around on the internet for information. I found the Let's Find Michael Bryson Facebook page, and I started skimming the posts in the comments. The circumstances of Michael's disappearance were so bizarre, and the people that were at the party he disappeared from seemed to be a colorful collection of young people. I couldn't keep myself from trying to piece it together. I started taking screenshots of things that I thought were relevant, and eventually my husband asked me what I planned to do with all of this research. And so the podcast idea was born. Before I had any interviews, I had planned on just gathering information from things people had posted and what I'd seen on the news. I gave myself a deadline of Sunday, September 20th, and I put it out there on Facebook so that I had to keep myself accountable. Friday, September 19th at 11 p.m., Parrish Bryson messaged me and said he'd be willing to do an interview over the phone the following day at 1 p.m. That moment was when this entire thing changed for me. I I'm your host, Amanda Papineau, and this is Nowhere to be Found.
This is Parrish and Tina Bryson. We're Michael Bryson's parents.
I was so nervous to make this call to Parrish and Tina. Who am I to come in and start asking these extremely personal questions to this grieving family? I knew my intentions were good, though, and I made the call. They are extremely easy people to talk to. Parrish and I are both talkers, and we've had many conversations since this day. They're always very pleasant, and we banter and flow through conversations easily. They're the type of people who you feel like you've known way longer than you actually have. And their story is captivating.
As far as Michael's concerned, he was raised in a normal middle-class home. He was involved with church since he was growing up, did sports, Boy Scouts, a well-rounded, if you will, well-liked young man.
Yeah.
Didn't know a stranger. You see, he went to Mexico, I think, twice with the church to go down and build homes for families. And then his first trip to Africa, I believe he was 17, and he went to Liberia for almost 2.5 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And did outreach to kids out in the bush, you know, to try to get them to come in and go to school.
Oh, that's amazing.
The emphasis of his very first tattoo was two hands shaking that said, be strong, my brothers. After that, you know, he came home and he finished his senior year in school, and he followed his sister's footsteps and went to Northwest Christian University for a year. And that's when we started noticing a little change in Michael as far as, I'm not going to say personality per se, but just some of the kids that he would hang with.
Once we started to get into Michael's life as an adult, Tina and Parrish were able to weigh in on some of the more recent struggles he's had.
Michael was turning to self-medicating himself as to try to make himself feel better.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
He was using alcohol and marijuana for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, is kind of where it started.
Right.
And then he started going to these, you know, EDM concerts and raves and whatnot.
Right.
And, you know, and everyone knows those are introduced with Molly and ecstasy. And
exactly.
Yeah. You know, so he started doing those, you know, it wasn't like he was doing it every day, but every time he went to a rave, he would. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that was one thing that we wanted to say from the very beginning, Amanda, was that, you know, Michael had his demons that he fought.
Sure.
But the bottom line is Michael's missing. He vanished.
Exactly.
And he said, Dad, he says, I'm going to go camping for a couple of days. I'm going to be out of signal. But I would like, I just want you to know that. He says, but I want to come home and do some more work so I can, you know, make a little more money.
Okay.
So he was planning on coming home, at least to Eugene, to our house, Thursday afternoon,
okay,
if not Friday morning before the other party.
So I got I was at work on Wednesday the 5th,
mm-hmm,
and I got a message from, Natalie, who is Michael's ex-girlfriend, and she asked me if I've heard or seen Michael. And I said, no, I saw him on the 3rd of August. He came over to our house. I actually did not know he was camping. He said that he was going to be out of service for a few days,
mm-hmm,
and then back into service to help Parrish on, I believe, Thursday with yard work.
Okay.
And so I did not know he was camping. Although I had sent a text to his phone Tuesday night, and I believe I said, "Hey, bud, what's up?"
Mm-hmm.
And then to not hear from him, that was pretty unusual.
Okay.
At 11:30 the next on Wednesday morning, while I was at work, I texted him and I said, "Hey, are you alive?" Because that's just
making sure.
You know, I mean, if I don't hear from my kids, I'm like, "Hey, are you alive?"
Yeah, you're not. Yeah, you know? I'm not just going to forget about it.
"Hey, are you alive?" And then an hour and a half later, I said, "Michael, this isn't funny. You know, uh-huh, contact me ASAP."
We've had two lists of people.
Okay.
both lists have about 30 of them on there,
mm-hmm.
and there's probably 20 to 25 that are on the same list, or on both lists.
Okay.
So I would tell you that there was probably 45 to 50 that were quote-unquote invited.
Okay.
But at any one time after the party got going, by people inviting somebody else,
yeah.
or passerby.
Sure.
The locals that saw what was going on stopped by to have a hit of something.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we get the up to 100 people. I know he drinks. I know he smokes. I know he does Molly and ecstasy at these things.
Mm-hmm.
But what else was here that Michael could have taken, so I know where to start searching? Seriously, from the very beginning, we have had no truth out of anybody's mouth.
At this point, I knew I wanted to talk to someone who was at the rave, but interviews were hard to come by this early on. Donovan was the first partygoer who publicly spoke. He was on the Rick Dancer show and then on the podcast. He was our first glimpse into this group and really helped set the scene for the Renegade in the Woods.
Hello?
Hi, is this Donovan?
Yeah.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I was actually roommates with the birthday girl for the party.
Okay.
So, yeah, my best friend's partner's with her, and yeah, went up there as a group on Monday. I believe it was around noon, a little bit before noon.
You drove yourself there?
No, I rode with the birthday girl, my roommates.
Alright, so you get there Monday, like at noon. You guys just kind of set everything up, I'm assuming.
Some people were there prior with like the DJ equipment and whatnot, but nothing was really set up officially yet. So we kind of set up camp and then went over and helped them set up the DJ, the stage, light dome. And
alright.
It was definitely like a mini Renegade out there. Had some resources, like a generator, and just kind of set up at a random camp out there. The second day, there was a little hiccup. I guess over the course of the first night, we got a noise complaint from like a mile and a half down. Somebody complained about the loud music because it's a ravine, so the acoustics travel. And the forest rangers came out that second day. And basically, like, came up, told us all that he was confiscating the DJ equipment, the speakers, all that. But then he kind of realized he was one man and there was, like, 40 people there and thousands of pounds worth of equipment that he was not prepared to carry out. They only come out there once in a while, you know, once a day, really.
Yeah.
24 hours, maybe. So we weren't really worried about him coming back that night specifically.
And then I saw somewhere along the line that maybe there was a photo booth there?
Yeah, it was not like your typical photo booth you might find in a bar. It was more like, you know those, just to kind of put it in perspective, you know those play structures where it kind of looks like a half dome?
Yeah.
Yeah, we had one of those set up. It was a 30-foot structure. He set up a professional, like, camera stand, camera, and then lights. We had, like, a beanbag in the middle and actually a couple swings hanging off from it. Michael was chilling near the photo booth, like, on the beanbag area for quite a while, actually, just kind of hanging out, resting.
Okay.
So today what I know about this photo booth is that it was not a professional photographer, but was actually just a friend of Michelle's that said that he would take some pictures for her daughter's birthday. It took several months, but eventually a thumb drive was given to the Bryson family with the photos from that night. Unfortunately, there were only about 100 photos, and none of them were of Michael.
Yeah, there was a short bus and then a, like, full-size bus, both school buses, mm-hmm. yellow school buses. And, yeah, if you, like, look on the Google Maps at Hobo Camp, you can see that there's two sides to the camp. And, on the larger side, there was a fire. There's the DJ set up in the very back area towards the woods. And then there was picnic table, the short bus, the 30-foot dome. And then there was a parking area. And on one side of that area, on the roadside, there was spaces for tents. And then if you cross the actual road, there's a whole strip for more tents. And then also an area that goes down towards the creek.
Okay.
So there was ample camping spaces. It was a little bit spread out if you didn't camp on the main side where the DJ was set up and everything.
Mm-hmm. Which side were you? Were you near the DJ?
Yes, I was, but I was kind of, I set up my tent a little bit further away, near a dry creek bed, just to stay away from the noise.
What about Michael? Where was he sleeping, you know?
I'm not actually sure. I heard that he was, he got there, and it was already late, so I'm pretty sure he didn't even set up his tent. So, I heard that he was, sleeping on the bus, which is hearsay. I didn't witness that, but yeah, apparently he was crashing on top of the bus that had a patio platform on the roof. Then also, at one point, I saw him, like, kind of resting on the beanbag near the photo booth.
Okay.
And then also, I would assume if he needed to, he could go back into Ben's car, who he rode up there with.
Right, right.
The night before he went missing, at one point, he told me that his wallet went missing on one of the buses that was there. And okay. That he had $600 in it, and that he hadn't found it yet.
Uh-oh.
But he didn't seem too upset about it, to my surprise, considering there was, like, $600 in it. But I was drinking with him, drinking some beers with him, and then also he was doing some ketamine, and that's all that I know.
I was trying to find out what types of drugs Michael may have been on when he went missing, because Parrish and Tina had told me that that's information that they hadn't been able to find out. Parrish gave me an example. He said something along the lines of, I need to know if Michael was on ketamine, because that would mean he would have only stumbled 15 feet or so and fell over. So hearing Donovan say that stuck out to me. In my mind, the possibility that Michael walked a mile or more just got a lot smaller.
I woke up, started searching, and then the word was that the twins were going back into town to call for help, and, come to find out, they actually went back into town, went to their house, freshened up, went and picked up a friend, came back out, and then had that friend drive back into service to call authorities and his parents, which then resulted into his parents finding out at 4 p.m., a whole 12-hour gap.
I asked Donovan what he thought happened to Michael.
He didn't walk off. He got in a vehicle because there's no way that he would have made it distance through that thick foliage with what he was wearing that night without leaving a trace.
Yeah, I
100% agree. And the distance that he would have had to make, it would have had to be made by a vehicle.
After talking to Donovan, I felt like I had a much better idea of what the party was like. I have never been to a party like that in my life. And it was surprising to me to hear how they had a stage set up, two party buses, a generator, and a light dome for taking pictures, all out in the middle of the woods, essentially. Donovan admits that he only really knew Michael on the party scene, and at this point, I wanted to hear from people who knew Michael really well. I reached out to Krista, Michael's sister, pretty early on. Krista is wonderful. She's like a magnet. She pulls people in with her warmth, and like the rest of the Brysons, our conversations flowed effortlessly, even though we were strangers. She's an old soul and an empath, and I knew we would easily become friends. Krista mentioned to me at some point that I should talk to Anna. She was a good friend of Michael's, and she helped coordinate the search for Michael and Eugene and the surrounding towns. So I called her. Anna was also very easy for me to talk to, because she's a no-BS type of girl. She doesn't sugarcoat things, and I respect her direct, down-to-the-point style. She also was able to give some insights into the dynamics of this group, even though she wasn't at the party.
So then when we got there, there was, Michael's family was there, and there was kind of this weird division of, like, the upper campground, because it was two campgrounds or two campsites right across the street from each other. And at this point, there was still one of the buses there that Michael allegedly, like, walked off of. Mm-hmm. And Michael's family was there, and then there was a few people from the campsite, kind of in the lower side, that were kind of looking for him. I'm sure there was some of them that were. So we, you know, like talked to them a little bit more about like what happened. And they just said that Michael looked at them and said, you guys don't want me here, like in the middle of a conversation, and walked off the bus, and they didn't see which way he went. We went home that night. We got a bunch of flyers printed out. I think the family had flyers printed out too for us.
Okay.
We had a bunch of people that printed out flyers for free for us too, which was really nice. But we came up with a plan. My friend Nina set up like a projector at my friend Brittany's house with a map of the surrounding towns, like Cottage Grove, Springfield, Eugene, etc. So we made a Facebook group for each town, basically, and posted it in the original Find Michael Bryson page and said, hey, we're going to have people, like, of course, still searching the forest, but if anyone wants to, like, volunteer their time to hang up flyers around these towns, message me or Cody, and we will assign you to a city, and we'll have you go from there, basically. So we had a home base set up in each town where one of our friends had a bunch of flyers and then a big map of the town. So when people would check in at the home base, they would say, okay, I want you to go to like this park, this store, you know, all the gas stations in this area. So it was pretty organized as far as like making sure like each town was plastered with flyers. So we got like, I mean, so many calls and like sightings of him potentially being in Eugene.
Really?
So we thought, okay, well, we're not getting any other like potential sightings of him in any of the other towns. You know, we were walking around Cottage Grove and all the surrounding towns asking people to see him. They said no. Some of the calls were like, you could tell the people were like a little out there and it didn't seem super like validated, but then there was like a vendor at the Saturday market that said, oh, for sure, I saw him here. And there was like a handful of people that you could tell like weren't just trying to fuck with us.
Right. And they had no reason to either. They're just like, man, I saw the poster and like, that's the dude I saw earlier for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we thought for sure that he was in Eugene. We kind of thought because there was like drugs at the party, maybe he like got too high and wandered off and like was in Eugene, because everyone that said they saw him said that it was definitely him and he was wearing that hat or like wearing this outfit. But he seemed really out of it, or like someone was helping him and he seemed like really, really out of it. Like he was like high on drugs or something.
Wow. Okay.
So we kind of came up with this theory in our heads that like, okay, Michael got too high on something, walked into town, and like, he's in a really dangerous situation that he wouldn't normally be in if he wasn't like in a normal mental state.
Right. He got super spun out and now he's in a different, like, that's what Parrish was saying, is like, he could be in a totally different state of mind or psychosis. Like, he doesn't even know who he is. That's how gone he could be if he messed with the wrong combination of drugs. Besides like family and friends, were any of the people who were originally camping with him at that party still there with you guys at that point or helping you guys search?
So Ben, the kid that Michael drove up with, he was helping us. He was in the forest most of the days, and he also was helping us search Eugene, and he was a part of all that planning, too. People from the camp, no. Like, it was maybe, like, the first day they were kind of, like, moseying around or, like, kind of searching, but also just, it seems like more of, like, them just hanging out. A couple of the people from the campsite like showed up at like home bases to hang flyers, but then just like we're talking on the phone super far away from everyone, kind of like just acting really weird and like never actually hung up flyers, which I mean, there could have been people there that I don't know that we're searching every day. So I don't know, but the people I do know and the people I was kind of skeptical about were not. I know one of your questions was, like, what do you think happened to Michael? And and it is speculation. I'm not going to, like, accuse anyone or anything. But, like, from everything I've gathered, my theory, I have a couple, is either, like, I think 100% I know that they gave him too much acid. And I think there was either, like, an altercation between him and someone at camp and something happened, like, not in front of everyone. Like, he was, like, murdered. Right. Or I think maybe he did walk off and there was some sketchy people down the road that maybe could have done something with him, too. Originally, what I thought, like, why they were lying so much about, like, acid being there was originally I thought he had wandered off and got lost, like, from the first day. And, like, they were just trying to cover acids because they gave him too much acid in case he, like I said, like, wound up dead. They didn't want, like, manslaughter charges.
Right.
But then I was like, you know, I think that they got all really high on acid and he like hit his head on something or like fell, you know, like they went to a swimming hole, we heard, the day before he went missing, and I was like, maybe, you know, he was really high and like jumped off a rock, hit his head, and they did something with his body because they were all so high on acid they didn't know what to do, and now they couldn't take it back.
Right.
But at this point, I'm really leaning more towards, like, I think they got him really high and he wandered off and something happened to him from someone else, because I think these are really shitty people that he was with for the most part, but I don't know if they're capable of, like, murder.
Listening to Anna's story made me angry. I could hear that she was angry, and I knew everyone else would be angry too, which is why I decided to switch the order of Krista and Anna's interview. Because Krista's take on anger and all of the emotions we feel during a trauma are spot on, and they really hit home.
So let's just go back before all this and everything was crazy. If I had just asked you on August 1st, so what's your brother like? Like, what's his personality like? What would you have said?
I would say that Michael is loving and funny. He's empathetic. He's accepting and he's very understanding.
I asked Krista if she could walk me through the events of the day that she found out Michael went missing.
And I went to work that day on the 5th and got a haircut and then came home and ate dinner and started watching Netflix. And my mom came home and she said, hey, like, Michael's missing. And so we all jumped in the car and drove to Cottage Grove as fast as we could, which is about an hour and a half from Junction City. And on the way, you know, calling hospitals and jails and contacting authorities. And but as soon as we got to the hobo campground and I put my foot on the ground, like, I knew Michael was gone because I couldn't feel his energy or his presence anymore. And so I would say, you know, that I feel like that has been the hardest, most difficult thing for me during this process is feeling like I was like 100 steps ahead of my parents and my family and his friends and my friends, and like just feeling like I just knew, but also wanting to have hope that he's still alive. And, you know, I continued to search and, but in my heart, like I just knew he was gone. I couldn't feel him anymore in my body. I feel like some people, you know, are angry at Michael for choosing drugs, or angry at Michael for going camping, or angry with Michael for what happened, but I'm not. And I think it's because I do understand the mental health piece and where he was at and kind of what was going on. It just makes me feel more understanding about it.
Definitely.
And not angry. In fact, I keep waiting, like, to feel angry, but I'm not. Like, I'm not angry with him. Like, it makes sense to why he went out there.
Right.
It just makes sense to me.
I think that's, like, a kind of a testament to your connection. It's a, anger is, like, a one of those impulse emotions. It's like you, if you can't process something, your brain uses anger to kind of hide that from you. And I think that you, it seems to me like you kind of skipped right past that and got to, like, that deep understanding, like, I'm not mad, I'm sad, I'm sure, sad. But I also, I get it.
Yeah, I would say, like, you know, and feeling angry is totally okay. I do want to say that. Like, feeling angry is part of the process. It's part of one of the grieving steps. Like, people feel angry and then they go into denial and they start to finally accept what's going on. And then they go into, you know, the depression stage, and then they go back into the acceptance, and they don't go in a row. You can experience them. You can accept it. And then 4 years later down the road, start to be in denial again.
Right.
So I get it, but just me personally, like, I keep waiting to be angry and I'm not. I'm just filled with really deep sadness. I'm very, very sad.
Yeah.
And I miss him and I love him. And
yeah,
I wish I could see him.
I wish you could too.
Krista shared with me what she thought Michael's legacy was, and it really struck a chord with me.
I really, truly think that, you know, obviously I wish my brother wasn't gone. I wish he was here, but I feel like that's his legacy, is number one, bringing people together and from all walks of life, you know,
yeah.
Like bringing a Republican together with a liberal and like singing together. Or bringing, you know, just those two worlds, like bringing people together and like making people feel loved and like a sense of community, which is what he's been doing like since August 5th. Like you become really close with everyone who you're searching with like every day, all day for months. So I feel like that was number one. And number two, like some of his friends, like it has changed their life already in a really positive way of like, you know, people don't want to do drugs anymore, or they're like, holy cow, like this is my wake up call.
Soon after this episode aired, a girl named Jessie contacted me and wanted to give more details on the puddling story that Anna told us about. She told me that she'd spent a lot of time with Michael in the 2 weeks leading up to the camping trip. She wanted to help me understand some of the dynamics of this group and shared some character testaments. Here's what she had to say. Many of the Renegade attendees went on an overnight hot springs trip in March earlier this year. In the last episode of Nowhere to be Found, Anna mentioned someone got spun out and left in the woods during this trip because they were new to the group and did not pass a vibe check. This is not what happened. However, it was definitely still eventful. Eventful enough for me to warn Michael about it before he went to the birthday party, and for me to not want to go with him like I was supposed to. The person who was supposedly dosed at the hot spring trip wanted people on here to know that he willingly got puddled and later even asked for more. He got too high and he ran off into the woods when we first got there, and Kyle River was the only one who noticed and ran to take care of him and bring him back. Donovan later got dosed with acid on accident. No one could remember or figure out how, and he had a really bad trip. I was scared for him. Everyone got extremely inebriated, and when the sun rose up, the group of 15-ish walked back to the cars. We lost three people on the trail on the way back, including Hunter and one of the other birthday party goers. The first car left before we realized part of the group hadn't come out of the woods yet, so we didn't even know three people were missing because it's literally the easiest trail back to the parking lot. Kyle River, again, is the one who took it upon himself to take our friend's car and drive back to service to call the first car that left us to come back and help search. He was freaking out, really worried. The girl driving the car wouldn't turn back because she had a doctor's appointment and said if we didn't hear from them by the time we got to Eugene, we'd send help. I just want to offer my perspective as someone that knows this friend group and the dynamic, and I know many people are confused as to why people went to town to pick up Kyle for help instead of the family or the cops. But honestly, to those people, Kyle is a skilled outdoorsman and a firefighter who seems to always know what to do in these situations. It was an absolutely horrible decision to not go get help immediately, but I want people to understand that this is not out of character. Especially considering that they were inebriated, I bet people were thinking Michael would turn up in 5 minutes and he'd be pissed as hell we got his parents involved. Jessie shares another story where this group was at a party and they were hesitant to call an ambulance in an emergency. And to me, it felt like she was noting a pattern. On Michael's birthday, where I met Hunter, one of Michael's best friends had a seizure on my lap, and we all thought he was going to die. It took us a solid 10 minutes to decide whether or not to call an ambulance. So stupid. He turned out fine, though, and ended up getting mad we called an ambulance. But I was extremely traumatized from that, and I remember trying to talk to Hunter about it because we were really connecting at the time. And he just kept saying it didn't bother him that he almost watched someone die. He kept saying he's seen worse and worked emergency rescue jobs, and nothing really got to him emotionally like that anymore. Which is kind of how he's been since Michael's been gone. So nonchalant. And I think that's just how he is with depression and dissociation. So for anyone who doesn't remember, Hunter is the partner of Josie, the birthday girl. In my opinion, some people misunderstood what Jessie was trying to say here. I've heard people say that her statement makes Hunter look really suspicious. What I think Jessie was getting at is that it actually doesn't make him look suspicious. Because in her experience, that's just how he is. He's been in many emergency situations due to his rescue jobs, and it's kind of numbed him from some things. That's what I got out of it, at least. The next interview I had was with Warren, and it really just landed in my lap. Tina messaged me on Facebook and asked if I'd like to interview Warren Michaels. It was October 7th, and at this point, Warren was kind of a controversial figure in this case. There was a lot of talk about him seeming suspicious because he had a criminal history, he didn't know anybody at this party, he'd possibly been in a fight the night before Michael went missing, and there was even rumors that he had a missing axe. I was trying to think more like a journalist and realized that I can't go into this interview with confirmation bias, and I'm glad I had that realization.
My name is Warren Michael, and in regards to how I got invited to this event, Michelle Edward, I met her one time at after hours on 3rd Street, and I would have definitely hung out with her in the future. So we exchanged phone numbers, mm-hmm. but a while later she hit me up, not the same night, but informed me that they were going to be having a birthday party for her daughter, who's 21, mm-hmm. and asked me if I'd like to go camping.
She picked you up at 11 o'clock, and you
guys... in the morning on Sunday.
On Sunday, okay. And then you guys go back to her place in Cottage Grove, you said, and picked up a couple people, and then go ahead.
Oh, we were all in different vehicles. I was with Michelle. Josiah, her roommate, drove his own white Ford pickup, and her friend Miranda drove her red Subaru. So three vehicles, four people.
So from there, you guys head out to Hobo?
We arrived at Hobo probably around 1700 or 5 p.m., 5:30-ish.
I realized right away that Warren has incredible recall. He's able to give very specific details and times. It's very impressive.
One in the morning, you know, everybody started rolling in, and we started taking over the camp spots and set up tents as the other people were leaving. And we were doing a lot. There's a lot of movement and getting stuff going. And okay. Once everybody started to show up, it was sort of finally everybody's here. Let's get this thing going and setting up a dome. And
yeah. Did you guys bring the dome?
Negative. That came up on a bus. I believe it came up on the yellow short bus, or it was in a pickup that one of the people who was in the convoy came up with. Those guys were, I was under the impression, let me make this clear. I was under the impression that all of this was like a professional setup. You go somewhere, I mean, I've done this in Southern Oregon with the Barker family in Cave Junction area. I've ran security for doors. I've done festivals before. Okay. I've done VIP for stage events, and I was under the impression this whole event would be catered from Falling Sky Brewery.
You were under that impression
questions from Michelle, but it turns out to be at no point a professional event. This is completely an amateur setup, bunch of kids partying in the woods who, you know, plug stereos in and DJ, and that's no disrespect to their talent, but
sure. But you were told it was going to be more of like a organized festival type of thing. With catering and a whole, like, you were expecting something grander.
Professional private party, yeah. So on Monday night, I walked down into camp, and come to find out, a lady from a campground down the road, she was all irate most of that time after. But when I came back down to the campground, this lady and one of the other party goers were fornicating in the open on a picnic table. And... I brought her over to the tent and set her down looking over the river. And I started to talk to her, like, what the hell's going on? Like, are you okay? And because she was initially, I observed her as being verbally responsive and coherent. And, mm-hmm. But I quickly found out this chick was trouble. Okay. And so she, once Jonah was looking for her again, we heard her and she got out of the tent. Well, this continued. The one thing I remember is this chick took my cigarette out of my hand and pulled out her breast and started milking herself to put this breast milk on my cigarette. She did that to a lot of people throughout the night. So this kept going. And I think she'd heard about this chick whipping out her breast. And I'm just like, oh my God. But it escalated because she kept harassing people sexually, verbally, yelling names at people, profanities, very aggressive, not welcome at all. She was actually multiple times. And then I was sitting around the campfire with Miranda, mm-hmm. and she walked up with no pants on and just put her, lady parts mm-hmm. in Miranda's face. And that's when I lit up on this chick and I was like, that's it. You need to go. And Josie, birthday girl, came over and Josie was tired of it too. And that girl got an ass whooped. Josie whooped that girl's ass.
Really?
Dragged her ass across the ground. Yeah, mopped her. Just like one of my friends did in the Navy, I saw, oh yeah, Josie put down the muscle on this girl. And if you ask me, that woman who had had it coming because she was threatening people. And so once people, and she actually asked, where's my purse? I'm going to grab my gun. Okay. And that's when shit got real. And then she got her, got mopped with. Yeah. She came, she actually went, she disappeared for a while. And then in the middle of the night, I'm in my tent and I hear her screaming. And she actually walked over to the people, the bystanders, the people who were in our party that said the noise would be okay. She walked into their camper in the hours of the morning, naked, and started yelling at the woman for being the person who her husband who cheated on her. So she wasn't even there anymore.
Oh my God.
Psychologically. She was gone. She was nuts.
Okay, wait, sorry. So what time was it when that lady went into those people's campers? Like the middle of the night?
It was more like almost, you know, I'm middle of the night to me is 10 to midnight, maybe 2 in the morning. This is more like 2 to 4 in the morning time.
Okay, okay.
And so then around 10:30 in the morning, that Forest Service officer showed up. And he was one vehicle, one officer. Man had bulletproof vest on, sidearm. He had the sidearm, hand-on sidearm, unsecured at all times because there were dogs present. Mm-hmm. And he did not know what the amount of people up there, what he's getting into, I'm sure. Because a noise complaint, this is what's odd to me, Amanda, is that the noise complaint, why that gentleman came up, came from a campground 1.5 miles down the road to the west.
Yeah, that was very specific.
Huh. It didn't come from the people. This lady just came into their camper and was trying to look for pistol moments before and yelling. I was like, wow. So that shocked me. I was like, I didn't speak to the gentleman personally, but this is what I heard from that noise complaint was from 1.5 miles away.
Right, that's what he said on the podcast.
There's no houses 1.5 miles away from what I understand. I don't know if at 1.5, but who's got cell service at 1.5 miles? You don't get cell service until you get back down to the Roe River intersection almost, unless you have a Verizon or a computer of some sort. But so I'm trying to figure out where that noise complaint comes because I figured it would have damn sure been from these people who hurt their rights and privacy were completely violated by this person who didn't know anybody there. He just came up and was, later found out that she actually came up with Josiah.
So when the ranger got there, what did he actually say?
I did not personally talk to the gentleman. Yeah, I did not talk to the gentleman at all. I just know that with my background training, when you see a Forest Service guy show up with a bulletproof vest on, you know, I'm not going to just, you don't just walk up to people like that, especially if you've got a tent on a sidearm. So you say, now you wait for the law enforcement officer to come to you if he's got a question for you.
Okay. So you just...
And, Michelle took representation for the camp pretty much. And she went up there and she was speaking to the man. From what I understood, he was more upset with the trash, the amount of vehicles, and the buses. Same. And when everything's done and said, I learned that he said, all these cars need to get out. Most of these cars need to get out here. You know, there's a limit. About an hour later, everybody in the whole camp, everybody was real cool with it. They got up, grabbed trash bags, and we started cleaning up the place. Everybody took that sheriff, the federal Forest Service agent officer's words. They did not take them lightly. They cleaned up quickly, which was good to see. I was happy about that. This time, as soon as he showed up, probably 5 minutes, 6 minutes into it, I'd gone down to the swim hole, the same place that I asked my ex-wife to marry me, and there was a few other people down there, but Miranda we were down there for a couple hours. And when we came back, that's when we found out about word of mouth of, well, this is what's going to have to go. The music's got to turn down. The Tuesday night, though, before sunset, a young man had walked up to me. I think he was the younger one there, the one under 21 years old, about 19 years old. He was a very polite young man. And he'd asked me if I wanted anything from town because they were going to go to Cottage Grove and do a beer run. And so that Tuesday night, I'd given him $20 for a pack of American Spirit Celadons and a 2-liter Coca-Cola. And he said him and pretty much 4 people were going into town. Wednesday morning when I woke up, the first thing I did was I looked at the table of people. Lazarus is over there. And I asked, hey, do you guys know where the kid went with everybody's stuff? It's like, you know, I wouldn't mind having a Coca-Cola and a pack of cigarettes right now. I just woke up.
Yeah.
And type of thing. And I was just told, who cares? You know, they didn't even get back till 3:30 in the morning. And I'm like, why not? And they said, they went to Eugene. Okay.
But now still, this, where's my coke and cigarettes?
Now this is an issue because then it wasn't. And I'm like, okay, screw it. I'm not $20. Okay, screw it. I can get a pack of cigarettes because Michelle Edwards had arranged a ride back for me. to town.
Wow.
This was a little bit after, because around 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning is right about when I was waking up. I hadn't even had a cup of coffee in me yet. Two people came into the campground, and that's when the first time I heard about Michael's whereabouts were. Two people came up. They had the dog, this black dog, everybody's favorite dog. Both recognizable faces to me. I don't know their names, though. Okay. Walked into the campground and was like, "Hey, has anybody seen Michael?" And there wasn't any worry in their voice. There was no indignation or, you know, it was just like, you know, "Hey, have you guys seen, you know, Billy Bob Thornton?" Or, you know,
yeah,
"Have you guys seen?"
Yeah, it's casual, you know, not urgent.
You know, Gumby or and Pokey, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And a lot of people like, "Oh, he's probably just asleep, and you know, he's probably asleep somewhere else." And okay.
Your response is probably, "Who's Michael?"
His stuff's still up in the woods. Yeah, his stuff's still up in the woods. His hammock's up there, but he's not. And that's when it was acknowledged that, "Oh yeah, anybody could be asleep anywhere on the ground, just taking a nap somewhere, technically."
So let's go back then. You wake up, Michael's missing. Somebody asked you casually. That's 8 or 9 o'clock, and what happens at that point? Other people, what happens at 8 or 9?
Oh, no, everybody, I mean, once the Michael was even brought up, everybody went about doing what they were doing.
Okay. Till what time?
And about, let's see, I started breaking down camp because I was going to get a ride back to town from Michelle Edwards, because I had to leave Thursday morning for my, my next event. A gathering. I was going up in the woods, in which involved a friend's family. He was up from Southern Oregon, Blue River.
So
and
you were supposed to get a
at
ride.
At one point, Michelle came up to me and says, "Warren, I went and I found you a ride home. I won't be taking you back." She's like, "I'm going to stay here and help with Michael." That was probably about 10:45, 11 o'clock. I feel that Michael was possibly alive when he left that campground. I don't think he left that campground hurt or harmed. I think he left that campground alive with somebody
okay.
and didn't come back. And that's why, you know, I've done search and rescue in Import City Forces training. It's, you find something. You find
right.
cases. You always find something. There's something. There's a clue. The Brysons have no clues.
Right, nothing.
I think Michael was taken from that campground without the information of ill intent, and he wasn't brought back. I don't think Michael, anything happened up there to Michael, because if anything happened up there to Michael Bryson and 40 people said my name, you don't think that those 40 people would have a problem whooping the ass to some kid who didn't know anybody else there, right?
They would have called you out day one. Yeah, agreed.
They would have called me up. I wouldn't have gotten out of there.
No.
You know?
I agree with that.
The way I put it, and I talked to Paris about this, if Michael walked onto that bus, when you wake up in the morning, or you're walking down the street and you see your neighbors, your friends in their house, you know, you wave through the window, right?
Mm-hmm.
If Michael woke up and was just, even if he went to take a piss in the morning, and he's walking back or walking by that bus, and he saw people he already knew, because he was supposed to come up with the twins initially, but he came up with Ben instead.
Right, right.
If he saw those people, you'd walk on and be like, "Hey guys, it's a party, right?" You'd be
yeah.
like, "What's going on?
Yeah.
How's your night?" You know, you have no reason to not. But if he saw something, though, if he saw something that he wasn't supposed to see at 4 a.m. on a bus, whether it's a financial trade of weight in a drug deal,
mm-hmm.
it didn't matter who his best friends were or not. If his best friends were even up there, it wouldn't matter, because in that type of a trade, in the horrible drug world, the people, the big guys,
mm-hmm.
those are the people who make the rules happen. And that's why safety issues come concerned with this, because if it goes up as high as we think, and it could involve certain people, and if Michael was murdered with a firearm, then anybody is a point
mm-hmm.
for anybody here. Anybody could go bye-bye.
Yep.
Just like they made Michael go bye-bye.
After Warren's interview, it took me a while to process it all. It was a lot of information, and I needed to sort what was and wasn't relevant to Michael. I certainly noticed how different it was from the only other firsthand account I'd heard, but I also heard the similarities. Donovan and Warren set up the same physical location of things. They agree on times that groups arrived, and they agree that the Rangers showed up on the second day. But Warren says that the party was pitched to him as a formal event. Donovan says it had some planning, but it was very casual. Donovan does not mention the crazy lady, and that stuck out to me the most. Donovan says at 8 or 9 when he woke up, people were yelling Michael's name, starting to search for him more seriously. Warren says when he woke up at 8:30, nobody was yelling his name. Nobody was showing any urgency or major concern. Not sure what to make of it, but I noted the differences. Like I said in Safe Haven, I had already interviewed the PI, Mark Perkins, about a month before his episode aired. I held on to his interview until we had heard a few more accounts, because most people wouldn't have known enough of the details and key players to get the full benefit of Mark's interview.
My name is Mark Perkins. I'm a licensed private investigator in California, have been for the past 25 years. I got involved in the Michael Bryson matter because my daughter is one of Michael Bryson's best friends. I did quite a bit of the work from my office in Northern California, mm-hmm. just getting names of people suspected and doing some background investigations on them to get a feel for who they were. And well, the thing is, and what always kind of bothered me about the whole thing is that the original versions of what happened were pretty consistent among the core group of people. Mm-hmm. And whenever that happens, it kind of raises red flags with me. Yeah. And one of the other things that was kind of disturbing is when he initially went missing, law enforcement didn't get up there, first of all, because they weren't even notified for 16 hours. Mm-hmm. But the first people that had showed up, from what I understand, were search and rescue, and law enforcement didn't actually show up until sometime later. And then when they interviewed people, and this is, again, secondhand, I mm-hmm. don't have firsthand knowledge.
Sure.
But when they interviewed people, they were like, it was like in a group setting. Yeah, the timeline, and everybody after, it's no clearer to me than the first day that I started.
Really?
I mean, you know, there are people claiming that they're the last to see Michael, and they immediately, jumped on it and rousting people in tents, mm-hmm. and going up and down the road in a car and all that kind of stuff at a certain time in the morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at this 4:30, it seems like 4:30 kind of is like the target time.
Right.
But then you talk to other people that had no clue that, you know, that ever happened. And so it's just, you know, and then I think that's one of Parrish and Tina's biggest pet peeve about this whole thing is that they just truly believe that there's something out there that people aren't saying. How does a guy get off a bus and allegedly they start looking for him within minutes after he leaves and he disappears off the face of the earth? I mean, I've talked at length with the twins and, they come across as very believable. I have talked to a few people that were up there at the time that are well capable of doing anything. Mm-hmm. Well capable.
I guess just in a general sense, if you had to guess, I know you don't know, what do you think happened?
All I can talk about is what possibly could have happened. And there were, several scenarios, and I have absolutely no evidence to support any of them.
Right. I understand.
You know, the thing, because the thing about it is, although they say a time frame of when Michael went missing, there's nobody to confirm that or to say that's when it happened. Mm-hmm. So the best I can find is that the DJs that were on stage at the time claimed that Michael was up with them about 2:00 in the morning. And then after that, there's really nobody except for the two people that were in the bus that claimed they were the last to see him, that claimed that he left around 4:30. So there's a big window of time when anything could have happened.
Okay.
And people are coming and going, and if Michael did walk off the bus under his own power and went either up or down the hill, I guess any number of things could have happened. He could have been, hit by a car. And somebody freaked out, took the body away. Mm-hmm. He could have wandered up into the forest. And when you go up there, you'll see how extreme the environment is. Mm-hmm. It's basically straight up in every direction you go. And so the road is the path of least resistance.
Yeah, especially wearing the shoes he was in, the situation that he was in. It just...
Right, right. But I mean, obviously he could have, laid down and fell asleep and overdosed, mm-hmm. and never woke up, and mm-hmm. they just haven't found the body yet. He could have been hit by a car. He could have run into the wrong people. I mean, all those things are viable possibilities. And there's also the possibility that he did just leave and he doesn't want to be found. There is that. I mean, it's, it gets dimmer every day, if you ask me, that's one of the scenarios.
But agreed.
I always tell people that listening to recordings of yourself is a unique form of torture. I think it's safe to say most people are surprised to hear what they sound like on a recording. I'm now ultra aware of how differently I speak to different people. My husband calls me the social chameleon, and I realized right around Natalie's interview how true that was. Even the tone of voice I use differs between people. I unintentionally mirror patterns of speech and grammar that the other people use. I become like them. I think I do it naturally just to try and make people more comfortable. When I'm talking to girls, for example, my voice is higher, I talk faster, and it's much more casual, like a girl talk type of thing. For guys, I speak lower, slower, and I seem more formal or professional. Not sure what all that says, but it's just another weird part of my life now. Talking to Natalie was great. She is such a sweetheart, and like Krista, she has this old soul feel to her. It was so obvious to me how much she loved Michael. Hearing the crazy things she did to look for him, staking out all night, exploring sketchy bike paths, and wandering the forest, it broke my heart.
The very first night I met Michael was a pretty brief encounter back in January of 2018 when my good friend Brittany introduced us on the dance floor at a show the three of us were celebrating our birthdays at. Michael and I also had other mutual friends, so it was a pretty natural flow over the next few months. We frequently started spending more time together and really started to bond. That spring, we went to a music festival together, and we just had so much fun, just the two of us one morning. And that's pretty much when we started to become almost inseparable. Michael and I just had a beautiful instant connection that really only continued to flourish over time.
So Michael, to me, I would just describe him as the most sweet, loving soul I've ever had the chance of knowing. His spirit is silly and playful. You could ask anyone who knew him and they would tell you he's the life and joy of any gathering. He's giving and generous. He's the kind of person who would gladly take his shirt off of his back for someone else. You know, he could make anyone feel welcome and loved. I would describe him as being so strong through all of his hardships. He still managed to strive forward every day and was always aiming to better himself. And I like always admired him for that. There's so many wonderful qualities and characteristics I could use to describe him. But really importantly, I want to add that he was the most loyal and trustworthy person I've ever known. He was the one person I trusted with my entire being. I could always count on him for love, support, all the smiles. Even on his bad days, Michael always knew how to bring like me and so many others so much joy, and I will forever be thankful for that. He is an amazing person, and I miss him so much. So roughly around 4:30 p.m. on August 5th, the same day he went missing, I received a message from our friend Jessie asking if I had seen Michael. She elaborated by explaining that she wasn't there, but had heard from someone, and this is a quote from her, actually. She said he went into psychosis, felt that no one wanted him there, and walked into the woods at 4 a.m. A lot of people were messaging me because they thought he might come here because this was one of his safe havens.
Right.
He didn't come here to feel safe. When we first went out to the forest, I just, you know, I think Krista said this too. I just had this feeling that he was not there. And, you know, and she's his sister and they're, you know, obviously very connected on that level. But, you know, Michael and I have always said we're cosmically connected. And, you know, he's always like, I don't know what the reason is, but we're connected and that will never go away. And I just, we've always been able to feel each other so strongly. And, you know, I was hiking through those woods and it didn't feel like he was there, but I wasn't gonna not exhaust every possibility.
Right.
We started getting potential sightings back in Eugene, so I immediately got in my car and I started, you know, driving around potential sighting areas as well as areas I know he enjoyed or might potentially go to. And then after dark,
our friends and I split up and started searching downtown on foot.
What do you think happened to Michael?
So I have many theories. Well, not, I used to have a lot more. I've got a few now. Mm-hmm. I'll try to keep it straightforward as I can.
Yeah.
I think Michael got mixed up with some bad people and something awful happened to him out there in the simplest of terms. But knowing what I know now, I obviously can't say for sure. I think it's a likely possibility that someone puddled him and either inebriated him for the purpose of foul play, or they puddled him and an accident happened and it was covered up.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened to Michael was evil and malicious or an accident, I'm not sure what to believe in that regard. But either way, I genuinely believe something went down out there that shouldn't have. And I truly believe that at least a few people know what happened to Michael.
In late October was the first time I spoke with Brett Surplus, another controversial figure here.
My name is Brett Surplus, and I live over here in the Pacific Northwest of northern Idaho. I previously, in my younger days, had a law enforcement career. I worked for a sheriff's department and then also for a police department. From there, I pretty much did quite a few years of fraud work for one of the top five major banks, and then decided to go ahead and create a TV show called Real Sportsman. So for the last few years, I've been the executive producer and the creator of Real Sportsman.
According to Tina and Parrish, Brett has done an incredible job and has given them more information than any other source so far. Brett says that he came to Eugene and he solved Michael's case in 8 days.
I jumped onto Facebook and someone had shared this interview with Rick Dancer. And I didn't know who Rick Dancer was or anything. But I saw his family, and I think that was, there was Donovan and then the Brysons. And so I'm, listening to what was being said, and I thought, well, that's kind of odd, So after the interview, I turned around and I went to the page that they had created. And so kind of reading through some of the comments and everything, and there were some things that kind of stood out to me.
Brett contacted the Brysons, and they agreed that he'd come out for 8 days to help them investigate Michael's case. He describes climbing down ravines, searching under cars, and busting a fraud case.
We need to look underneath this car. I said, because this car was pushed on purpose. They dropped the trees on purpose. And it's all been within the last 30 days. And so we pulled that vehicle up, and surprisingly, there was nothing. No disturbed turf underneath. We ended up, uncovering another case, and it ended up being a unemployment fraud scam that was going on, that these this married couple were going around to the homeless people and to these people with drugs and getting their social security numbers and then, handing them some money and then filling out the information through the state of California and then having these refillable unemployment cards sent to them. I got down to the spot, and it was very eerie. It was kind of like a fortress, as if you had this creek bed down below, but then you had this kind of big makeshift or this big rock cliff edge coming out that I was under. And, I would start to see where a bear had been working it. And so I started to get a little nervous, going, okay, there's a bear working in here. And so, my heart's kind of pounding. I'm by myself. I got no radio. I know they're way up top. And I start to go in further, and all of a sudden I start to find bones. Once I kind of got through it or whatever, I figured, it was pretty much a small deer or something, and it had been there for quite a while. And I think it's, a couple more days and looking and then talking, and then that's when we ended up, I said, I want to talk to Donovan. No, it was just one of those things where it's like, if there was anything that he was holding back because of the fact that he, the Brysons had been there when he did the interview, I felt that he wasn't going to say in front of them. So what we were going to do is just go and have pizza. And then I was going to talk to him and say, hey, can I talk to you alone or whatever? Do you mind talking to me real quick? And so that was the plan. So I said, hey, do you mind talk with me, just you and I, because I'd rather talk to you about, you know, kind of a more personal one-on-one without DeBryce, you know, without the Brysons being present. He's like, yeah, that's cool. So we started getting in, you know, and a lot of it was, you know, he's really trying to be protective of one certain individual that he hangs out with. The one thing that I was noticing as I'm gathering and I'm remembering through that, something that kind of sticks out to me, and that is it wasn't the 4 o'clock thing that was setting out to me. What was setting out to me is that at around the same certain time frame, everybody had some place to be. So I ended up, you know, we did our, you know, I wrapped up my interview with Donovan and whatnot. And, we were sitting in there and we were talking about guns and all this other stuff. And I had my AR in the case and I put the case on the bed. I opened it up and let him hold it. And he's like, man, this is just like modern warfare. And we were joking around and stuff like that. Parrish and I are sitting in the motel and then all of a sudden, we get a message, the one message that we've been waiting for. And, the one thing that I needed. And, all of a sudden it was like, whoa, wait a second. And then the message then turned into a phone call. And then the phone call, ended up and I said, okay, well, how about we meet tomorrow? And, cause people are scared. So now we've wiped the board. We've now all of a sudden this has become the main focus. It's like the whole thing has changed. And so the next day, the persons that we end up getting in contact with, come and talk to us and give me, things that were said. I've got visual proof, things of that sort, things that all tie into it. So everything all of a sudden it was like, bam, we just got our answers. Basically what it was, all I can tell you is that we know that a certain group showed up at a certain time frame. They changed the vibe of the whole camp, which is the reason why everybody around that time frame decided to go somewhere.
I was surprised to hear that Brett was referring to a new group. He said he was looking for the partygoers to confirm that this group showed up and changed the vibe. This would be news to me. Nobody that I've talked to has told me about another group that showed up and changed the vibe. Brett said that he knew exactly what happened and the timeline, which is obviously way more than anyone else has ever claimed to know. I was both impressed and a little skeptical, to be honest. I certainly have more questions now than I did at the beginning of the interview, but I understand the way an open investigation works, and we're probably pushing the line already. Sounds like they might be onto something. I hope the things that need to fall into place do. Brett went back to Idaho, and everything seemed to be going fine, until Donovan put out a public statement, and here's a portion of it. On October 5th at 3 p.m., I was to meet Parrish Bryson at the Best Western Hotel, where he said he was in a meeting with a search and rescue member to coordinate more searching. We were then to go have lunch. I had met Parrish and Tina at this hotel before in a conference room with Mark Perkins, their hired private investigator, to do a podcast with Rick Dancer. Due to this, his meeting place request did not seem odd. Unfortunately, Parrish lured me to the hotel under false pretenses. On the 5th, he had me meet him in his room 308. As I walked in, there was a man with a sidearm on his hip, bulletproof vest with AR mags on a chair, and a video camera facing a chair in the corner of the room. This man introduced himself as Brett, then stood in between me and the door. Shortly thereafter, Brett asked Parrish to leave the room so that he could talk to me one-on-one. He had a dry erase board on the wall with names of people written on it, as if he was conducting an investigation. After a forceful interrogation, where I was made to sit in the chair and be videotaped, while being what I considered to be falsely imprisoned due to my inability to leave the room, he told me that he's a problem solver, and that he is here, in Eugene, to do that. Brett stated he has a team of 6 with him and that he is watching the twins' house. Next, he told me not to tell anyone and that they're listening. He showed me his AR-15 and a sweatshirt from his military group, Panhandle Band of Brothers. As we walked to meet Parrish at the nearby pizza place, Brett told me that he's here to punish people, And he asked me repeatedly if Kyle Rivers is someone that needed punishing. And that if so, he will make him disappear off the face of the earth. With this being said, I fear for the safety of my friends, family, and myself. And now, here's Brett's response to the situation when I asked him during our interview.
I think it'd be a good time for him to retract that because I think, you know, one, it's recorded. And then not only that, but two, you know, I made this comment. I mean, it's like his prints are all over my gun because he's holding up to it. And it's like if he was held at gunpoint, then why is it he's holding the guns?
Mm-hmm.
And then not only that, but there's also another person who isn't involved with this party who he had sat and had pizza with. And he'll attest to the fact that this guy was making jokes and everything at the table with us. There was no way that this guy was scared about anything.
So obviously there are some similarities in the stories and some differences. Brett told me that the sheriff's department has the video recording of Donovan's interview, which would be able to put this all to rest if someone tried to press charges or anything like that. This was a sticky situation for me to manage as someone who was covering this case. I had to be careful to not choose sides so that I could hear both sides of the story from the same perspective. The statement that Donovan put out was the beginning of what I now refer to as the rift. When the statement hit Facebook, people were very upset and went on the attack quick. In response, Brett went on Facebook Live and spoke for about 30 minutes. He explained basically what he said in my interview as well. The video was met with a lot more backlash. The rift grew deeper when some of the partygoers started a second Facebook page called the Let's Find Michael Bryson Support Page. They said they no longer felt safe speaking on the original page and wanted to start their own page where they could say whatever they wanted without fear of backlash or censorship. Things got ugly from there. Each page, in my opinion, became less about Michael and more about slamming the other side or defending themselves. Internet trolls flocked to the pages to watch and take part as the drama unfolded. Luckily, everything simmered down as of recently, and each page has decided to take a step back, it seems. I asked Brett if he thought the two pages could ever mend, and he said yes.
There's two things that need to take place, and that is one, everybody needs to swallow their pride, and the second thing is that there's two parents that need to be basically removed from the equation.
I also received a message from Tina recently, showing me that she had reached out to Donovan. It read, "Donovan, it's been almost 4 months now, and I think we need to bridge our pages and bring Michael home. That is and always has been our only purpose. Things have been said and feelings have been hurt. I apologize for anything we have said that may have offended you. We love our son and have been hurting. I feel like we have all lost sight on Michael's pages, and he wouldn't want that, I'm sure."
In your opinion, what do you think happened to Michael?
I think people in life make decisions. I think they get caught up into different worlds. I think people that you think are your friends, can think of you as a burden in some ways. I think that, evil exists in anybody, if there's a reason. And I think that this was a set out plan. It was a planned event, and I think that someone who is in the world or whatever that was there at the rave is the one who advised them that he was going to be there, and here we are. If Michael truly was your friend, as much as you say that he is, that you cared for him, then come talk to me about that little stuff. And I guarantee you, you're not going to be ousted by any way whatsoever. Show your friend that you really did care and you do love him.
So after talking to Brett, I started to focus on the idea that I wanted to talk to someone who was awake at 4 a.m. when Michael went missing. So back to my research I went. The Let's Find Michael Bryson support page is being referred to as the Partygoers page. So I watched as people posted their personal accounts. I eventually saw Bree pop up on there and say that she was awake at 4. So I messaged her and she agreed to do an interview. I felt like Bree was one of the more transparent people I've talked to so far. She didn't seem to sugarcoat things and was the only person I've talked to who admits to being high that night. I commended her on it, and I felt like we had a genuine conversation, and she was able to add to the timeline quite a bit for me. Another thing Bree did for me was point me in the right direction for the next interview that I did.
So my name is Bree. I was invited by the birthday girl, Josie, and Hunter. Started seeing my partner earlier this year, and he's pretty good friends with Hunter, Josie's partner.
Okay.
So just over the past, like, 6 or 7 months, I've been hanging around with them a lot more. Nice. And, like, getting closer to them and stuff. So she invited me when we were at the grocery store.
Cool.
About a month before her party. My partner and I didn't leave town until, like, 11 p.m. Oh, okay. So I got there, like, 12 or 12:30 the morning of August 5th. When we got there, it was pretty chillin'. Like, a decent amount of people had went to sleep. Like, certain people that I knew were going to be there were asleep.
Mm-hmm.
I know there had been some things that had transpired the couple days before. Like, a little bit of drama went down, so some people went home. Everyone was just kind of burnt out. So it was a pretty chill vibe when I got there. Mm-hmm. I think everyone got there, like, partying out the couple days before.
Okay, did you see Michael when you got there?
I did. So it was like maybe 20 minutes after I got there. He had like came out of, you've been to the campsite.
Yeah.
So I was at the park bench near the campfire, and I was sitting there like eating some food that I'd brought from work, and he had came out of like the bushes kind of over near the stage.
Okay.
I think he had just thrown up. Yeah. So he like came over and like we said hi and we were joking around with him and stuff. And then kind of like he went and sat by the beanbag or something. Didn't really talk to him much when I got there. He seemed pretty high. I thought he'd eaten Molly because he looked like he was like, I don't know if you've ever been around someone where they've eaten Molly, but he was like sweating a lot. Mm-hmm. He seemed like he was having a pretty good time, but someone was getting him water.
So he was kind of struggling a little bit.
Yeah. So I didn't go to bed till way later, like okay. Till the sun's coming up the next day.
Okay.
Yeah, so we got there, everyone's just having a chill night. I eat dose, so I was candy flipping, so okay. I don't know if you're not familiar with the term or not, but it's eating Molly and acid. And so, because Kieran shows up in the car with Jazzy and Ashley, and that's a while after I got there. Mm-hmm. And then their friend Sebastian comes on his motorcycle sometime after that, probably around 3.
Okay.
And then we're just all kind of like goofing off. I had seen Michael actually when Kieran got there.
Okay.
When Kieran showed up, he came over to say hi to Michael, or Michael came over to say hi to Kieran. He sat in the back of Kieran's car while they were like unloading some of their stuff. And that's the last time I think I saw Michael. And then Sebastian got there while after that, and we're all hanging out at the dome. And then Kasaya had came over and was like, hey, has anyone seen Michael? But nothing too alarming. Like, nobody thought he was missing. We just thought that she was trying to, like, you know, talk to him about something.
Mm-hmm.
I saw her go over and ask a couple people that were sitting near the campfire, kind of watching the stage area,
mm-hmm.
watching the DJs. So I know she was asking around a little bit about him. I'd stayed up, and then, like, I remember the sun had started to come up, and that's when I was like, it's like, yo, okay, I'm worried. Like, it's been hours now. Like, mm-hmm. I'm pretty concerned. And there had been talk about kind of what to do, but I wasn't really a part of that. I wasn't really like, I felt like I don't really know Michael as much as like the twins or Josie. And like, you know, I'm not in a state to where like, I'm gonna, you know,
lead the charge.
Or like, you know, wander off. Like, I wasn't about to start. I didn't start looking until the next day, mm-hmm. like looking up near the creek or anything. Like, I was like, I'm not in a state to where I can do that. I'm going to get myself lost. And so I had fallen asleep right around when the sun had come up.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I woke up, Kyle got to camp a little while after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of was like, I don't know if someone went to town specifically to get him. I think maybe someone just let him know what was going on once they got service, and he probably felt the need to come.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, hey, can you swing by and pick me up, and I'll come, like, help out?
Yeah, something like that. Oh, yeah, because his car had been there.
So then why go to town if it's not for...
I think that people went to town to try and talk to his roommates or his friends and see if anyone had seen him in case he did get a ride back. That was kind of the priority before any officials were alerted, just in case.
Yeah.
And so then Michelle was really like, we need to call. She was really sick of waiting. She was like, I want to call. Like, been waiting all day.
Yeah, she was starting to freak out a little.
And so we were trying to figure out, like, okay, I believe what happened was someone went to town and got food because, like, we had, like, no food there.
Yeah.
And my boyfriend was like, yeah, like, so-and-so is going to bring back some food. And so then I think at that point, like, his family had been contacted by someone. But, like, they had heard that people were looking for Michael. Because shortly after they showed back up with food, his family showed up. They asked for, like, you know, what happened, what drugs was he on. And I feel like that's where a huge misconception came from. Like, I have not been quiet about the drugs that I knew were there, that I used, that I believe Michael had used.
I end all my interviews with this question, but I know it's speculation because we don't know. But what do you think happened to Michael?
I think that he ran into people that are capable of something really horrible. I don't think it was anyone that I was camping with. It was at Josie's party. But
possibly just someone else in the area.
Especially since there's been no trace of him. And it's been months, and I haven't even heard anything from my friends that I was camping with. Any type of, like, odd behavior from them or any reason to believe that someone that I know is hiding something. That's the only thing that makes sense.
Okay, so that brings us to very recently. I knew that putting a timeline together needed to be done, and I also knew what a tall task that was, especially in an audio-only type of way. The only way I could break it down was to go through the interviews of the three people we've heard from that were at the party, which is Donovan, Warren, and Bree. Anytime one of them said a time, even a rough estimate, I wrote it down. Now I had essentially three timelines that I needed to merge, and here's what the result was. So Monday morning, August the 3rd, Warren was the only one at the party at this point. They set up for the event, and between 9 and noon, people started showing up. At 12 p.m., Donovan, Josie, and Hunter show up. The party starts going in the afternoon. Something that we knew from Parrish and Tina was that Michael had a doctor's appointment at 6:30 p.m. that night. And at 8:30 p.m., Michael and Ben leave Eugene. 10 p.m. Monday night, or between 10 and 10:30, Michael and Ben arrive to Hobo. Between 10:30 and 11, Warren says Josie fights the crazy lady. Uncertain of what time, but sometime that night, Michael tells Donovan that his wallet is missing with $600 in it. That leads to early Tuesday morning, between 2 and 4 a.m. The family in the RV have a confrontation with the crazy lady again. At 10:30 a.m., the ranger complains about the amount of cars and the music volume. Around that same time, Warren heads down to the swimming hole. The next account we have is at 7:45 p.m. Tuesday night, he gives money to someone for cigarettes and soda. At 8 p.m., Warren goes to bed with earplugs. Sometime that night, Michael and Donovan are drinking beer, and Donovan sees Michael do ketamine. Wednesday morning, or Tuesday night, between midnight and 12:30, Bree and her boyfriend arrive to Hobo. At 2 a.m., Bree says that she takes Molly with Donovan. Between 2 and 3 a.m., Donovan says he goes to bed. At 3 a.m., Bree says that Kieran arrives and Michael was sitting in his car talking. This is the last time that she sees him. At 4 a.m., Bree helps Kasiah look for Michael in the dark with a flashlight. At around 6 a.m., Bree goes to bed. Between 8 and 8:30, Warren wakes up. Nobody's searching or yelling Michael's name. No organized searching of any kind. No urgency. Between 8 and 9 approximately, Bree wakes up as well and continues searching. Donovan also wakes up between 8 and 9 a.m., says he starts looking when he wakes up with Kyle River and some of the twins' friends. Michelle sets up water, food, and a list to organize how people are helping. At 11:30 a.m., Warren leaves to go back to Eugene with Jake. At 12 p.m.,
Ben wakes up and starts panicking. Kyle and Ben drive back into town to call for help, according to Donovan. At 7 p.m., Bree leaves Hobo about an hour after the family arrives. This timeline is going to continue to get filled in the more people I talk to. I truly feel the easiest way to grasp it is to see it visually. What I'm going to do is post a visual representation of the timeline to the Nowhere to be Found Facebook page. Very soon, we're going to be starting a website for the podcast, and it'll include the timeline and much, much more, so stay tuned for that. As of today, December 13th, 2020, there's been an update in Michael's case. Parrish Bryson wrote this on the Facebook page this morning. We would like to take this time to update you all on what's happened this week. On Monday, we got a call from an individual who spotted something on the other side of the creek on Bryce Creek Road, a mile west of Hobo Camp. LCSO and SAR were notified. Upon arriving, they were able to collect some of the items that Michael was wearing when he was last seen. They asked us to inform the public to stay out of the area while they conducted a few more days of searching. After combing through the area, search and rescue didn't find any more clues. We want to thank you all for your prayers and support during this difficult time. Next time on Nowhere to be Found.
My name is Kieran. I knew a good few people at that party, including the birthday girl. So I got to the party. I drove up there myself with my friend Jazzy and Ashley in the car. I think I got there around 1. I know Ashley had met Michael the night before and thought he was super sweet, so I think she introduced us with some other people. The big bus, I think the thing was that some other people funded it because they didn't have like cash on hand, and then they were going to pay it back.
We've been asked how our listeners can contribute to the show, so we set up an account with Patreon. Check out the link in our show notes if you're interested in supporting our cause. You can also find it on our website, nowheretobefoundpodcast.com.